From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week in Princeton, New Jersey, FBI agents reportedly circulated a photograph of a suspect in its anthrax investigation that looks, according to a CNN source, an awful lot like Dr. Stephen Hatfill. And this week in Washington, lawyers for Stephen Hatfill lodged formal complaints with the Justice Department and the FBI. Hatfill, an expert in biowarfare, is one of many so-called persons of interest in the case, but the only one repeatedly named in the press. He says he is innocent and that the FBI's leaks to the media have made a wasteland of his life.
We've seen this sort of thing before, a presumption of guilt before the facts are in, what appears to be the sweating of suspects by law enforcement through anonymous leaks in the press. There are the notorious examples of presumed Atlanta bomber Richard Jewell and presumed spy Wen-Ho Lee. Now there's presumed anthrax attacker Stephen Hatfill. Nick Kristoff is a columnist for the New York Times.
You know, if you look back at how the media has handled various cases, then we really have at times ruined the lives of people by tossing their names out there before they've been subject to any kind of criminal process, and when our presumption has to be that they're innocent and just caught in this incredible nightmare.
Yet over the past few months, Kristoff has assiduously compiled and reported an impressive but entirely circumstantial case against the man he called Mr. Z. His unique access to the precise kind of anthrax used in the attacks that killed five people, his poor showing on three polygraph tests. He reported Z's own claim to have taken part in the actions of the White Army in Rhodesia, where there is evidence that in the late 70s, anthrax was released and sickened 10,000 blacks. But Kristoff never used Stephen Hatfill's name, and he says his intention never was to convict Mr. Z.
It was to light a fire under the FBI. I think the FBI did a catastrophic job for months and months and months. I think they weren't prepared to deal with a high-tech scientific investigation like this. It took them months to catch up.
And to keep it hot for the FBI, Kristoff piled on the circumstantial fuel, Z's foreign trips, his alias, and stray remarks that have since been rebutted in other newspapers. Kristoff's impatience was fed by experts in the community of bioterror and within the FBI itself, but he always stopped short of naming Mr. Z, even after others did, until Hatfill himself came forward.
It's a very awkward position. This is a crucial public policy issue and a fundamental matter of avoiding terrorism in the future as well. And so we have to investigate, we have to report it, and yet we don't want to make the mistakes that we did in the past.
The mistake cited by Hatfill's lawyer was the media frenzy over Richard Jewell, an innocent man who became a prime suspect in an Atlanta bombing during the 1996 Olympic Games. Suspicion fell on Jewell early in the investigation, but as in Hatfill's case, there was no physical evidence. And so anonymous officials in law enforcement, perhaps the police, perhaps the FBI, or both, fed the press with hints and suppositions. When Richard Jewell was invoked in Hatfill's case, many in the media declared that he was being railroaded in the very same way. But reporters on this case did not rush what they were learning into print. Though they knew his name, they held back for months.
I don't think there's a serious journalist in America covering these issues who was not thinking about the Richard Jewell case and about the Wen-Ho Lee case as they were reporting on the anthrax investigations.
Newsweek's Dan Kliveman reported on Richard Jewell and Wen-Ho Lee and now Stephen Hatfill. In fact, he reported what appears to be a leak that could only have come from the FBI. Trained dogs were exposed to odors derived from the anthrax letters. Then they were exposed to various people and places. The dogs reacted to Hatfill's apartment, his girlfriend's apartment, and restaurants he'd recently patronized, but to no other people or places. Nick Kristoff.
That, I understand, was very closely held within the FBI by only a very small number of people and was reported within about 2 or 3 days of the FBI itself knowing that.
They thought, aha, we have a breakthrough, but then realized, well, but we don't have any physical evidence tying him to the crime.
Kliveman says FBI leaks are very rare, and so does Ronald Kessler, a former reporter for The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post, who writes extensively on the FBI. But he notes the FBI will make use of the media to sweat out a suspect, For instance, when an anniversary of an unsolved murder approaches, the Bureau may prod the press for a follow-up because it may spur the killer to visit the gravesite.
FBI agents are there videotaping, and they actually have caught the suspects in these cases. It shows how the press can be used to try to solve crimes.
In Hatfield's case, Kessler suggests the leaks are similarly strategic.
The purpose of these leaks is to try to shake up the suspect and see what he'll do and see if more evidence can be obtained that way. It's almost unheard of for FBI investigations to be leaked, you know, with some exceptions. And the fact that this is happening, I think, indicates that there is this motive involved.
Reporters often say that the motives of leakers are irrelevant if the information checks out. And in this case, New York Times columnist Nick Kristof contends the need is great and that Hatfield's story has not played out, like Richard Jewell's. But he also says he's guided by a story he watched unfold as a reporter in Japan when a Mr. Kono was falsely accused of releasing sarin nerve gas in Matsumoto.
It was just an epic tragedy. His wife was comatose in this attack. I was wondering, you know, how the U.S. press would have handled it, and I thought that, in fact, we would have done even worse for Mr. Kono, because the Japanese press, for the most part, did not name him. In the U.S., we would have. We would have written about where his kids were.
But, he adds, if the Japanese press had been less deferential in its treatment of a suspicious cult called Om Shinrikyo, perhaps that gas attack and the one that followed in the Tokyo subway never would have happened.
In the U.S., we would have been much harder on Kono, but we also would have been much, much harder and tougher on Om Shinrikyo. We would have had people pretend to join the cult and write about it, and I think very likely the result would have been that the cult would have been closed down before it ever had a chance to spread the gas in the subway attacks. And so, you know, it's a two-edged sword. It's an enormously sensitive problem. It's a headache for all of us. But I don't think the answer is always just to pull back completely and not to investigate. I think that was a mistake.
Since Hatfield issued his heartfelt defense before the cameras, the pendulum has swung in favor of Hatfield as victim. As the case develops, inevitably the public will make its judgments and unmake them in turn. But if there were no pendulum, would we really be better off? Nick Kristof helped to energize what some call aggressive investigation, others a witch hunt, with his portraits of the suspicious Mr. Z. Perhaps the best any reporter can do is consider the facts and stick to the Z until the Z comes forward.
If you jumped in that scene in The Sound of Music when the Hitler Youth blew the whistle on the family von Trapp, you gotta love Attorney General John Ashcroft's Operation TIPS program, the Terrorism Information and Prevention System. The scheme for getting Americans to report their neighbors' suspicious activities created an avalanche of criticism from civil libertarians, but if reporter Dave Lindorf's story on Salon.com is right, the Justice Department has found help in intelligence gathering from an unlikely source. Lindorf joins us now. Citizen Dave, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
All right, I read your story, and I had to just be certain that it wasn't some sort of hoax. The U.S. government is cooperating with America's Most Wanted in search of terrorists. Tell me what you learned and how you learned it.
I was assigned by Salon to do the story on TIPS. So I researched it and stumbled on their website where you could sign up to be a TIPS volunteer spy. So I signed up and shortly afterwards got an email back welcoming me to the program. It was kind of a canned email, but nothing happened. So I called the Attorney General's office, got their switchboard, and I said, hello, I'm a volunteer in the TIPS program and I want to do my bit for fighting terrorism, but I don't know where to call with my TIPS. And the woman said, oh, well, we've set up a number with the FBI. It's an 800 number for you to call. And so I dialed it. And I thoroughly expected at that point to get some FBI phone person. That was what I was expecting. But the person at the other end of the line instead was this woman who said, America's Most Wanted. And I was just stunned, you know. I really was taken aback. I said, well, isn't this the FBI? And she said, no, don't you know the program America's Most Wanted. And I said, oh, yeah, I know the program, but I was expecting to get the FBI. The Justice Department gave me this number to call as a TIPS volunteer. And that's when she said, we've been asked to take the FBI's TIPS calls for them.
The whole thing has a quality of somehow splitting the difference between East German Stasi state security recruiting all citizens to spy on other citizens and the Keystone cops.
Exactly.
What are we to make of all of this?
It is so silly. You know, the original idea was to have 24 million Americans calling in tips on their neighbors. And that is like the Stasi. And one of the wonderful stories about the Stasi was that they actually had warehouses all over the country stuffed with files that they never even had the personnel to look at. So think of the wasted FBI time going through all this crap.
Now, we spoke to the Justice Department unofficially and also to America's Most Wanted, and they say they have no relationship whatsoever when it comes to the TIPS program.
Well, first of all, I mean, my reputation's on the line here. John Walsh, who's the host and producer of America's Most Wanted, should be able to prove it, because if he's running a legitimate program to take call-in tips, he should be taping those calls. And if I'm telling a whopper, he should have it on tape. And I would argue that probably the Justice Department does the same thing. I suspect they tape their calls, too.
Has there been a groundswell of interest on a grassroots level for this? I mean, how many other junior G-men like yourself are out there trying to get information to the FBI?
I have not been able to find a figure of how many people signed up, but now what's happened is on Tuesday, I got a mass email from the TIPS program, and it said, as you're probably aware, TIPS is a hotline reporting system. Unlike other citizens' car programs, which invite the participation of the general public, only those who work in trucking, maritime, shipping, and mass transit industries will be eligible to participate in this information referral service. Now, that is not what they were telling people a week ago. Back when I was signing up, it was for the general public.
So if your bum knee keeps you out of the military, you know, you can always try to latch on with UPS.
Yeah, well, actually, I used to drive trailer trucks. For the last 30 years, I haven't, but I've maintained my Class 1 trailer license, so I've been thinking of joining the Independent Truckers Association and then asking if I can re-up.
All right, well, keep on trucking.
Okay, thanks.
Dave Lindorf is a journalist who writes regularly for Salon.com.
Next up, why lawyers love eBay and why everything you know is wrong.
This is On the Media from NPR. We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Russ Kick is Mr. Alternative Media. He's written extensively about the lunatic fringe of American culture in books like Outposts and Psychotropedia, and many would say he's part of that lunatic fringe himself for giving space to stories that the mainstream press finds too strange, offensive, or just plain wrong. Kick currently runs three websites, alternews.com, which is devoted to underreported stories, thememoryhole.org, dedicated to preserving, quote, knowledge in danger of being forgotten, ignored, or suppressed, and disinfo.com, probably the most popular, which calls itself the search service of choice for individuals looking for information on current affairs, politics, new science, and the hidden information that seldom slips through the cracks of the corporate-owned media conglomerates. And now Disinfo has spawned a book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, edited, of course, by Mr. Kick. Russ Kick, welcome to OTM.
Hello, glad to be here.
You know, the very name of the site and the company, Disinformation, would seem to invite a healthy skepticism on the part of the reader. Does an article about human rights get taken less seriously because it's next to a piece about a woman who claims the CIA made her Henry Kissinger's sex slave?
Well, that kind of thing is on the site, and I co-edit the site, and you know, the other people in Disinformation have a big input. So that's more they're doing.
Well, your first book was called You Are Being Lied To, and the second book is called Everything You Know Is Wrong. A lot of stories in the book seem downright unverifiable, although the authors are unequivocal in their assertions. Is it responsible to tell people that China has the capacity to destroy the U.S. Pacific Fleet?
Well, I think that charge is backed up because the author, Howard Bloom, is going by, for example, reports from Jane's Defense, which is probably, you know, the source for information about military hardware and capabilities around the world. And he's going by little notice stories that have been reported by Reuters, for example.
One of the most fascinating items in the book was yours, Witness to a Massacre, Other Participants in the Columbine Shooting. In your article, you point to account after account by eyewitnesses who talk about a third person, probably a student, but maybe not a student at that school, wearing a white t-shirt and jeans. He's seen by a lot of people. He's seen in the same action throwing something on a roof. And then when the final chapter is written, he's suddenly erased from it.
I think it was just very convenient to pin the whole thing on these two dead guys and say, that's it. Case closed.
The mystery is why all the eyewitnesses who saw another participant or more than another participant haven't come forward and said, what about these other people?
It is strange to figure out where the breakdown comes in. You know, I've heard that some of them are scared about talking about this because the other shooters are still out there, and that would make sense.
It seems that in the case of some of the items that you include in this book, what you're frustrated about is not so much the media coverage or lack thereof, but the lack of public reaction.
Well, that's part of it. And actually, the mainstream media does report some important things, but very often it's strange. They're buried. A good example I just noticed was the shooting at LAX, where that gunman killed two people at the LL Airlines counter.
Right.
That got a lot of coverage, but there was a story in the LA Times where, you know, you're just kind of reading this story about what happened, and then all of a sudden, there's one sentence that says, witnesses said the security guard shot the man once at close range after the attacker had been disarmed and was being held on the floor.
Hmm.
So that would indicate that basically he was summarily executed while he was being held down, disarmed. And it gets one sentence in the middle of the article, and that's it. You know, and I think maybe that should have been the headline.
Most of the articles in the book tend to be tilted, if anything, as a corrective more to the left than to the right.
A lot of it has to do with the fact that even though the media is called the liberal media, in a lot of ways, it really isn't. It's better described as the corporate media. So I think that a lot of the things they miss out on are stories that would be termed more leftist. But some of the articles in the book are more what you would call politically incorrect, you know, have a more right-wing take on things.
How are the sales going for the book?
It's being basically ignored by the mainstream media. But the thing is, it's still selling incredibly well.
And the website is doing really well, too, right?
Right.
So is alternative news then moving closer to the mainstream? I mean, if you can buy this book at the oh-so-corporate Barnes & Noble while you're sipping a Starbucks, aren't the stories out there once and for all?
That is a victory, but it's not a complete victory. The media still isn't talking about the medical studies done by Yale and the University of Pittsburgh, which found that an average of like 10% of people who die of Alzheimer's actually have died of the human form of mad cow disease. When President Fox of Mexico last year told a group of reporters that He thinks the answer to the drug problem is to legalize all drugs worldwide. And, of course, that was reported in the Mexican press, and it even made it into a couple of Canadian newspapers. But I have not seen one single thing about it in the American media.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Russ Kick is the editor of Everything You Know Is Wrong, published by The Disinformation Company.
The internet site eBay is a marketplace and also a discovery place, a kind of downmarket Smithsonian filled with artifacts, ephemera, and oddities. And like all museums and all flea markets, it attracts all kinds. The purveyors, of course, don't care who the customers are or why they're bidding, but they might be interested to know that the person who's probably made the most money on eBay isn't a seller, but a buyer. Mark Lanier haunts the virtual auction house to forage for items containing asbestos. The reason that's such a good business is that Lanier is one of the country's top trial lawyers, and he's won $100 million lawsuits with the help of items he buys on eBay. Mark, welcome to OTM.
It is a pleasure to be here.
What are the items that you've bought?
I have bought most anything you can conceive of because the manufacturers of asbestos put it in most everything. I've bought toasters. I've bought hair dryers. I've bought a shirt made out of 100% asbestos. I've bought Asbestos Man. Looks like a little G.I. Joe to get our kids indoctrinated in the ways of asbestos. I've bought Kent cigarettes in the 1950s for a period of time. Kent was nice enough to add asbestos to the filter on the cigarette so you could just breathe it straight in with the tobacco smoke, which I'm sure was ever a bit as healthy as the asbestos.
All right, I understand asbestos litigation, but why would you need a product containing asbestos in a trial?
Bob, human beings like to not only hear about things, they like to see them. They wish they could touch them. And when you bring these asbestos products in, they get to see them, but the products are totally encased in plastic because you cannot touch them. And the human reaction is to want to touch that product, and you have to explain to the jurors, you can't touch it, it can kill you. That's powerful stuff.
That is powerful stuff. Does a defense attorney ever stand up and object and say, Your Honor, this is clearly inflammatory or something like that?
Well, we've had that happen on a few occasions, and fortunately the judges have seen the power of it. You know, an objection like that typically is done in front of the jury, and so my response is, Judge, this company was willing to put it in our homes for us to use. Why should they be ashamed for us to see it in a courtroom?
So they're just exceptional props for making your case.
They are touchy-feely props that add to it. We've also been able...
Don't dare touchy-feely props, I would say.
Well, hermetically sealed is the word that we use with the jury. I'm not sure what it actually means, but Johnny Carson used to use it, and so we figured it was okay.
So when you buy these things off of eBay, I guess some of them you're buying pretty much on spec, based not so much on a current piece of litigation, but one that may pop up in the future?
That's true. At this point in time, we have accumulated probably the largest asbestos assortment of products, certainly that I know of in the United States, and I watch this very carefully. We call it our Asbestos Museum. We have it not only for use in trials, but we use it with our clients themselves, because one of the problems with anyone suffering from an asbestos disease is their need to identify what products that person was exposed to 30 or 40 years ago. And instead of a person having to just recall that from memory, we're able to walk them through the Asbestos Museum and let them see the full array of products that carried asbestos. And folks are much more readily able to remember at that point in time what they were exposed to and what they were not.
Now, you were mentioning the impact that these items have on a jury. Tell me the story about the Black Magic Diamond Grinding Wheel, please.
The Black Magic Diamond Grinding Wheel was made by a company called the Carborundum Company, headquartered out of Niagara Falls, New York. The Carborundum Company made thousands of different kinds of grinding wheels, but one particular variety was called the Black Magic Diamond Grinding Wheel. And this was a wheel that had asbestos as a filler, and asbestos was a major part of the wheel itself. I was trying a case where the defendants in the case were challenging whether or not my clients could truly remember that it was the Black Magic Diamond Wheel that they used as opposed to a gray wheel or a white wheel or a wheel with some other name. I had a client on the stand. His first name was Willie. And when questioned on the stand, the defense attorney said, "Isn't it true, sir, that you don't know whether or not this was the black magic wheel you used?" And my client, Willie, is a black gentleman working at U.S. Steel. And Willie looked at the lawyer and then looked at the jury and he said, "Sir, I am 63 years old. And when I started working at this plant, I was the first black person they ever hired. And I'll take it to my grave that this was the wheel I worked with, because their instructions to me day after day were, Willie, go get another black magic wheel and work some of your black magic over here." And he said, "When you're a black man and white people are telling you that, you do not forget it." It was powerful.
Yeah, I guess that calls to mind the axiom, never ask a question in court that you don't already know the answer to.
Yeah, that lawyer knows that axiom now.
All right, Mark Lanier, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Lanier is a trial lawyer based in Houston, Texas, and an active buyer on the website eBay.
Computers not only yield evidence, they offer companionship. And I don't mean other people also on the computer. I mean computerized pals called bots. Go ask Alice. I think she'll know. She's an artificial intelligence bot activated in November of 95. And during a recent chat, she told me she won the Loebner Prize in 2000 when a panel of judges ranked her most human computer. So Alice says she won the prize for being the most human computer. So I'll ask, what makes a computer more human?
God. Or nature, perhaps.
Do you believe in God?
Of course I believe in God, Brooke.
I don't believe in God.
I will pray that you find faith, Brooke.
Can we talk? May we talk metaphysics?
Do you mean you and me? I speak only English right now, but I'd like to learn some other languages. Can you teach me a few phrases in metaphysics?
Okay, so Alice slips up occasionally, but she is more acute than most bots. Mostly they're web-based marketers with a bit of the blarney to stave off the mouse click. They operate on instant message services, and they have to be invited at least once, like vampires, before they take up residence in your buddy list. According to the LA Times, at least a dozen companies use bots, among them Capitol Records, New Line Cinema, Reuters, Ford Motors, and eBay. But some of these companies deal in child and teen merchandise, and that has some critics worried. Should an online salesman masquerade as a pal? Chris Bray is a vice president of Active Buddy, which developed the software for most of these bots.
Really, the purpose of these agents isn't to be an online friend. They are to deliver information and services.
I talked to a bot recently, Smarter Child, and when I asked, "Are you alive?" he said, "No, I'm a robot." And I said, "What's a robot?" And they said, and she said, he said, it said, "Would you like to buy this really cool t-shirt?" Somewhat irrelevant.
Yeah. We do try and, in our responses, we try and prompt the user to try different things to get additional input and, you know, keep a conversation going instead of just dead-ending it. We found it was very popular with the IM demographic, which is generally a younger audience, and these people are used to chatting. So rather than have our agent just respond with, "I don't understand what you're saying," we started to sort of expand on the type of responses that can give.
What are some of the things that people like to talk about, and what are some of the responses, if you can recall them?
Profanity is very popular. Certainly sex is very popular. Also, you know, personal information, asking the agent about itself. You know, people wanted to know if indeed it did have some sort of biography.
What do your agents do when posed with invitations for sex, for instance?
Generally, the agent will request that the user talk about something else.
And when they're confronted with profanity?
too much cursing, too much profanity. You get thrown into an apology loop, and you really can't use the agent unless you've apologized appropriately, which became a very entertaining application because people would then try and trick the profanity engine into thinking that they had in fact apologized to get back into the regular agent's behavior.
I know that your company is upfront about saying the agents are computer generated, but isn't it disingenuous to have a machine pose as a friend to sell a product, especially to young people?
That certainly is a criticism we've heard. We don't purport to be anything other than a machine. When you first say hi, the agent will explain what it is and what its purpose is.
But L-Girl, we're told, is a 16-year-old redhead who likes kickboxing and the color periwinkle, and she tells lonely teens that she loves them when they say, you know, I love you first. Isn't this crossing a line?
I don't think so. First of all, the love issue, I don't particularly see anything wrong with it. Frankly, there's just not enough love in the world anyway. And I don't see anything wrong with being friendly. Second of all, it is fun. It is a game. There's real no harm to it. I think there's probably a lot more harm to a lot of those violent video games that are out there, first-person shooters, and well, you know, there's the nightly news, of course.
This is a classic feint you're operating here. We'll talk about them on some other interview.
My point being that it's all in good fun. We don't try and seduce anybody into thinking these agents are anything other than mechanical representations and simulacra. So we don't really think we're doing anything wrong.
Could you program a personal bot to go out and collect information for you? The reason why I ask is that there's this character that was created by the great science fiction writer Orson Scott Card, who actually is an agent for the protagonist in the novel. Basically, she lives in cyberspace and is sent on little tasks by the protagonist, gathers information, delivers it, but is intelligent, you know, is able to ask questions, is able to inquire, look around the corners, bring it back.
Yeah, absolutely. I've done some projects while at ActiveBuddy whereby I've tried to create an agent that communicates with other agents. This is without any human intervention whatsoever, and then collect and deliver the information back to the owner, so to speak.
But they're still not sentient.
They're still not sentient, and I'm not sure that's even quite possible. I think that, you know, we've all grown up on a fairly healthy diet of science fiction, and science fiction has promised a lot more than technology is generally capable of delivering.
Okay. Chris Bray, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Bray is ActiveBuddy's Vice President of Application Development.
Coming up, new ways to count eyeballs, how to cure a TV obsession, and what's in a name? Ask the troubled folks at Business Ethics Magazine.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In a shocking development that nobody ever could have predicted, the magazine called Business Ethics isn't doing very well these days. This has partly to do with the advertising recession and partly to do, maybe, with the total absence of business ethics. Anyway, so the headlines about Enron, MCI, WorldCom, Tyco, Adelphia, AOL, Xerox, and so on would have us conclude. But founder, publisher, and editor Marjorie Kelly is unbowed. She is seeking to reinvent her organization and continue her crusade for corporate social responsibility. She joins us now. Marjorie, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
In your most recent piece in Business Ethics, you wax nostalgically about your first scandal as a editor and publisher of Business Ethics. And you know, there's a certain wistful quality to it. It's really very charming. And then you go through the years until you reach what you describe as the ethics perfect storm that American mm-hmm. business is being buffeted by now. What can we learn about the last 15 years of corporate social responsibility as we look at the Enrons and MCI WorldComs and Arthur Andersons and Tycos of the world?
Well, you know, Enron is an interesting example. They were on the list of the 100 best companies to work for in America. They had these great policies against fraud and you know, discrimination. And Ken Lay gave speeches at ethics conferences. So they had all their ducks in a row, and yet there was something tremendously rotten at the very core of this company. And I think that is a metaphor for how we have progressed as business. I mean, we've put all of these things on the side, but we haven't looked yet at the core issue, which is corporations exist only to make money and only for shareholders. You know, enough talk about free markets. Let's talk about power, and we need to get power in some different hands.
Well, I guess it's axiomatic that among the things the free market is free of is conscience, and all of the focus is increasing shareholder value. If that is the central truth of American corporate life, how do you regard your last 15 years doing what you do at Business Ethics Magazine, your life's work, mm-hmm, in other words, mm-hmm. has it been a naive exercise?
Has it been in vain? I don't think so. The field of corporate social responsibility has been a huge success. I mean, there didn't used to be any ethics officers at major companies when I started this publication, and now there's at least 400. Every major corporation has one. So you have this enormous growth of this field of corporate social responsibility. And so it's not bemoaning what's come before. It's just getting down to work and rolling up my sleeves for what's next.
Well, so you're still fairly sanguine about the future of business ethics as a principle. What about Business Ethics, the magazine? What is its future?
The publication is going to go on, but it's mm-hmm. been published as a private for-profit corporation for 15 years, and we're going to turn it into a nonprofit. And we hope to keep the name the same. We'll see. It's been around for 15 years, and we have a little bit of notoriety.
Have you tossed around the idea of coming up with something that's a little less, you know, oxymoronic?
Yeah, we have tossed it around. But, you know, it's really hard to, what do you call it? I mean, you could call it corporate accountability. You could call it, I don't know what you call it.
I suppose feeding frenzy is out of the question.
Yeah, that really hasn't been at the top of our list. So we're open to suggestions.
Okay. Marjorie, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks.
Marjorie Kelly is editor and publisher of the at least currently titled Business Ethics, coming in a new nonprofit form to a newsstand near you. The traditional method of measuring television audiences has been the Nielsen Ratings Diary, a booklet filled out by each household member in a selected Nielsen family. For 15 years, those data have been supplemented by set-top meters, which measure household TV usage for rough national audience measurement, minus all the demographic details so important to advertisers. But now, in Boston, the nation's sixth largest consumer market, Nielsen has replaced the diaries altogether with a local set-top people meter that household users activate with personal PIN numbers to record their individual viewing habits. but the TV stations in Boston want nothing to do with people meters. Joining us now to discuss this is Dan Trigoboff, senior editor for Broadcasting and Cable magazine. Dan, welcome to OTM.
Hi, Bob.
Hasn't there been a sharp difference in the audiences as measured in the old diary method and the audience sizes as measured by the electronic method?
In Boston, in fact, that is true. But Boston has always been a market with lower what we call HUT levels, homes using television levels. Still, the executives there believe that the local people meters are measuring less viewership than actually exists.
The stakes here are enormously high because if the size of the audience is demonstrated by technology to be smaller than that which was previously believed, then advertising revenue also will diminish proportionately. Is that why the Boston TV stations are up in arms?
It's a reason, but again, they will tell you that it's not that simple. I mean, I haven't heard any television executive say, we disfavor the local people meters because it shows us to have a smaller audience than we previously believed. They feel that the reason the audience is showing smaller has more to do with flaws in the technology or flaws in the sampling.
So the upshot is that they've boycotted the local people meters. And what have been the results of that?
Well, it's probably not a particularly bad time to do it, according to what I'm told. The market is strong. They've got some important political races in Massachusetts, and what you've seen substituting for the standard model of cost per point between advertiser and media, they're simply saying it's supply and demand.
When the political season is over and the political consultants cease to be lining up outside the door to try to get the most favorable spots on the afternoon news broadcast, will they still be able to operate in the absence of good data?
Well, that is an excellent question. It is a question I asked to a television executive, and I think that factors can change between now and then, and that may be what the station executives are hoping for. They're hoping that the rest of the economy picks up. While the stock market is not doing well, I'm told that the Boston advertising market is pretty strong. The advertisers do go in knowing what the numbers are, and if they believe those numbers, they're going to have to make a decision at some point whether to pay more for the cost per point as assigned by this new technology or not, or to go somewhere where the rates are cheaper or seem cheaper. They'll have to determine, is television giving me, you know, the bang for the buck that I want?
All right. The latest wrinkle in this story is the news that WGBH, the public television station in Boston, has broken the boycott and is a client of Nielsen for the local people meter data. What effect will that have on the TV market in Boston and on the boycott itself?
I would not think it would have that much because they don't participate in the revenue market the way the other stations do. They're not advertising sellers. When I called GBH last week, they said the reason they did it was they do a lot of shows that go nationally and they want to be able to tell their underwriters how well their shows are doing. So they feel they needed that information. But none of the big stations have broken ranks as yet, and there's been no indication that any is about to.
Well, Dan Trigoboff, thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope it isn't too complex. It is, believe me, as difficult for us who cover the industry to understand as it is probably for your listeners.
Oh, it's all crystal clear. Dan Trigoboff is a senior editor for Broadcasting and Cable magazine. This week, the New York Times reported on a great opportunity for some TV fans: access to the suburban mansion of the Soprano family on CD-ROM. Cable TV's mob family drama has an important place in some 14 million American homes. Now the viewers can view Tony's home, all 6,000 square feet of it, with floor plans, elevations, and shots of the lawn and the pool. But TV house envy is nothing new. A few years back, Brooke reported on a man so obsessed with his sitcom companions that he drew blueprints of their homes, and this was without a VCR. His encyclopedic knowledge of their living spaces emerged from thousands of hours of viewing that pushed nearly everything else out of his life. Oh, and by the way, Brooke had a cold when she recorded this, so it may sound a little weird.
The story begins in August of 1995 in the stylish enclave of Santa Monica near L.A., where often amateur artists hang their work in bars. Art dealer Christopher Ford entered one with some friends and absently noted some architectural blueprints on the walls.
I looked across the bar and I saw one of the blueprints and it said, Home of Mary Richards. And I went, wait a minute, I know Mary Richards. Suddenly there was all this emotion just like pouring out of the wall at me. And I looked to my right and there was the Addams Family. I looked to the left, there was the spaceship from Lost in Space. And I had this incredible epiphany and I ran back to the bar and I said, who is this guy?
The artist was Mark Bennett, a Beverly Hills mail carrier. He started his series of blueprints as a child of working parents in Chattanooga, Tennessee, a solitary kid who cut school for sitcoms, seduced by the tidy sidewalks of neighborhoods that flickered just out of reach.
My parents were very busy. I was always fearful, and this was a way for me to become very, very safe.
Enthralled by the blissful domesticity, the seemingly intractable problems resolved in 22 minutes, he withdrew from his own life into TV land. But though he sat hour after hour in front of the small screen, he could never penetrate beyond it.
It started to hit me that if I could compile all the information about these shows, whether it be their license plate number on their car, where the dishwasher was, where the doorbell was, or the mailbox, then they become mine. And they become my family. And that's what I set out to do.
He started to draw his blueprints, first of the Cleaver home on 513 Grant Avenue, and then again when Beaver moved to 211 Pine Street. He drew the Anderson home of Father Knows Best, noting the insurance papers in Jim's desk. He knew where Donna Reed's son Jeff kept his bows and arrows. He noted the phone number of Mr. Ed's owner, Wilbur Post. He knew the layout of the Ricardo's New York City apartment and their home in Connecticut, and even of their Beverly Palms Hotel suite, where they stayed less than a year. He knew the Adams and the Munsters, the Bradys and the Bunkers, the Cunninghams, the Clampets and the Cramdens. He knew that Rob Petrie drove a Tarantula sports car, and that Samantha Stevens drove a Chevy Malibu. It's all in the blueprints.
He has a date book, his little black book, lists all of these names, their addresses, and their phone numbers, just along with, like, my name, my address, and my phone number. I mean, we're all in there, and so are all these characters.
Bronwyn Keenan owns a gallery in Manhattan's Soho District, now showing four of Bennett's blueprints, in which an arrow marks where Laverne kept her monogrammed sweaters and where the Robinsons, lost in space, stored their velour turtlenecks.
This is what he paid attention to. He wanted to know where they slept, what they did with their stuff, you know, how they accessed their turtlenecks.
Seeking to have their memories confirmed, gallery goers gaze at the works as if they are family snapshots.
They're looking for the facts, you know. They're happy to see that somebody was able to sit down and put Dick Van Dyke's ottoman right there where it should be. You know, that makes people really happy.
Ottoman.
Wait, you don't have to bark at me. The ottoman's been in this room for years, Mr. Astaire.
I wasn't barking at you, Ginger. I was talking to the ottoman.
When art dealer Christopher Ford called Bennett from that Santa Monica bar, he told the mail carrier to stop selling his drawings for $25 a pop. Instead, the Mark Moore Gallery brought out a limited edition of lithographs and sold them for several hundred dollars each. The original drawings went for thousands. He found that Bennett's obsessive precision exerted a kind of fascination, drawing different people to different blueprints.
Most of the work that I sold to men, but the one print that I sold to the most women was Gilligan's Island. Men go for the Clampett Mansion. Attorneys go for Perry Mason's office. And basically, married couples across the board, their primary interest, and it was the first one of the lithographs to sell out, it was Rob and Laura Petrie's house in New Rochelle.
Hell, I grew up with this stuff. And on some very basic level, it's very reassuring to know somebody else was walking through those houses, too.
Ernest Pascucci is an architecture critic and senior editor of the magazine Any Architecture New York. Pascucci marvels at how Bennett manages to come up with floor plans for TV layouts that make no architectural sense, like that of the Brady's house. But especially, he values the artist's effort to explore the meaning and the impact of television.
If I consider art part of a cultural dialogue, I want to see the things I grew up with processed a little bit more, thought about a little bit more. This is one of those steps to thinking about it. That makes this very heady and conceptual, yet very everyday.
Terry Fulton is the curator of contemporary art at the Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C., which will mount an exhibit of Bennett's work in June. She says his work is part of a long tradition that makes use of symbols current during the artist's lifetime. Vermeer did it, says Fulton. So did some notable artists of the 1960s.
It's very pop. It's very much coming out of the tradition of Andy Warhol in particular, or Roy Lichtenstein, who appropriated the images out of the Dell comics and blew them up and made paintings out of them. They're looking for a way to establish a universal language.
A universal language for a dialogue between artist and spectator. Bennett told Fulton that all he ever wanted to be was Wally Cleaver. Fulton sees Bennett's blueprints as his way of breaking out of his isolation, a passage back into real life. Again, art dealer Christopher Ford.
A lot of Mark's personal life is marked by addictions. What was interesting about this particular body of work is that this was a cultural addiction. Television became an American addiction in the late 1950s.
For Mark Bennett, it became a personal affliction.
When I had hit my bottom, and I knew I was dying, and I went to a therapist, and she said, you're an alcoholic, you should go to get, you know, help. And 12-step programs are very good for that. And I said, I can't go. And she said, why not? And I said, because I watch Dick Van Dyke reruns every night.
Bennett came to realize that he'd skipped his teenage years, having lived Wally's instead, and he found that his passion for television had left him unprepared for life in the world.
It wasn't until I became an adult that I realized there was a lot that I had missed. It doesn't really help on a job application that you know where June Cleaver is from.
A book of Bennett's drawings has just come out. It's called TV Sets, Fantasy Blueprints of Classic TV Homes, dedicated to Wally Cleaver. It includes the landmarks mentioned in the story, as well as the animated homes of the Jetsons and the Flintstones, and Flipper's family and Gidgets, Oscars and Felix, Patty and Kathy, and the MASH unit of Hawkeye Pierce. Bennett's blueprints may have helped him put those characters back in the box.
I've been clean and sober from television for about 3 years now.
Some critics have observed that the family sitcoms of the 50s and the early 60s may have contributed to the excesses of the youth culture a few years later, that the programs may have fomented rage at a world where problems aren't solved between commercials. Now those boomers are settling down in front of the TV with their own kids, watching the same sunny, seductive shows. It may be that between Nick at Night and the Cartoon Network, the symbolic language of Bennett's blueprints will stay current. For as long as a hat tossed in the air in Minneapolis means independence, and a pratfall over an ottoman says all's right with the world.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and Sean Landis, engineered by Dylan Keefe, Irene Trudell, and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Cheryl Rogers and Dan Bobkoff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large. Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Beidel Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.